I will introduce the panel to you again. To my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofino. And I understand both sides are now ready to go. So if you call the case, please. Okay, thank you. Nathan, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, this is a case about an alleged defamation. It involves a youth baseball association with volunteer parent coaches coaching their children and other adolescents serving as the umpires. It involves parents of the players raising concerns in a meeting about the on-field behavior of one of the coaches, Mr. Williams. Now, the controlling question in this case is whether the Texas anti-SLAPP statute, SLAPP is strategic lawsuit against public participation, applies. Now, this Citizens Participation Act, if it does apply, should result in the dismissal of all of Mr. Williams' claims. The statute is intended to protect people who exercise their rights of free speech from retaliatory lawsuits, which would essentially amount to bullying, where someone vindictively sues a person to force them to spend time and money on a lawsuit, or where the threat of that kind of lawsuit would cause people to remain silent when they would otherwise raise their concerns. The statute clearly applies in this case. Mr. Williams, in his petition and in his briefs, talks at great length about how his son wound up on what he perceives to be the less desirable of two all-star teams after a meeting of the baseball association to which Mr. Williams was not invited, or if he was invited, did not attend. He believes he was defamed at this meeting. He's filed suit because of that, and we're here today because of that. That is clearly a public exercise of speech, whatever said at that meeting. It's no different than a homeowners association meeting or a meeting of people who are potentially buying into timeshares, or a bunch of folks talking about major issues of the day at church, at a bar, or any other place where people congregate and talk about issues that concern them. And the second part of the Citizens Participation Act is that it has to be about a matter of public concern related to the well-being of the community. Now, this is not about gun control or health insurance or any number of issues that are popular and are widely discussed that are about the well-being of the community. But it is about the behavior on the field of coaches who are teaching children important life lessons such as sportsmanship, teamwork, manners, discipline, commitment to long-term goals, practicing in order to be ready for a game, sacrifice, in t-ball less applicable than in adult baseball, but at some point a kid's going to learn to bunt. So those are all matters of public concern about raising our children to be good citizens.
I did get your joke.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sacrifice bunt. Go ahead.
particularly given I was probably the worst little leaguer Fort Worth has ever seen, that's kind of ironic, but.
Personal admissions will not be held against you, Mr.
Actually, I think my father has said that on the record. it was bad. Now, once we've met those two prongs of the act, and we clearly have, the burden shifts to Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams, at that point, has the burden to bring clear and specific evidence of each and every element of the causes of action he has alleged. Now, that clear and specific evidence language in the statute is critical because, unlike a comparable motion for summary judgment, Mr. Williams is not entitled to rely on evidentiary inferences. He has to have direct evidence. The El Paso Court of Appeals just this last month addressed this issue in an open meetings case under the Citizens Participation Act, where the evidence that is required is evidence unaided by presumptions, inferences, or intendments. Now, looking at his causes of action, Mr. Williams has a cause of action for defamation. He has a cause of action for intentional infliction of severe emotional distress, a cause of action for conspiracy to defame, and a cause of action against Mr. Beard for aiding and abetting Mr. Bilbrey in the defamation, or the alleged defamation. Now, those causes of action, he doesn't have direct evidence to support them. Mr. Beard will address the aiding and abetting claim. The conspiracy claim is straightforward. He would need evidence that Mr. Bilbrey and Mr. Hall, the president of the Baseball Association, agreed ahead of time to maneuver him out of the possibility of coaching. And he doesn't have any evidence of that. He would need evidence that they agreed ahead of time to defame him, and he has no evidence of that. Now let's step back to the next cause of action, intentional infliction of severe emotional distress. He doesn't have any evidence that he is in a gap filler tort situation. His pleadings consistently, his petition at the trial court, his response to the motions to dismiss, and his brief at this court say expressly that his intentional infliction claim is based on the defamatory statements. So he's saying, I've allegedly been defamed, and therefore I also get intentional infliction of severe emotional distress. And as this court learned in Jackson versus Credit Watch, that is no longer appropriate under Texas law. The Supreme Court does not permit pleading in the alternative of intentional infliction of severe emotional distress claims. Even if it did, he doesn't have any evidence that the alleged conduct of Mr. Bilbrey or Mr. Hall rises to the standard of seriously criminal or almost criminal in nature. So, as a matter of law, he's failed to present evidence to support his intentional infliction claim. Now let's look at the underlying alleged defamation. The direct evidence that he has, as opposed to just his suspicion about what was said at the meeting, is an email. Now, that email doesn't use the word abusive. The entire email is attached at tab 13 in our brief. It talks about Mr. Williams yelling at an adolescent umpire on the field in public. He tries to turn this into defaming him by saying he was abusive of children. Well, abuse can mean many things, not just physical or sexual abuse. It can also mean verbal abuse. It could mean using profanity. It could mean yelling in a loud voice. So these words in this email aren't defamatory. These are the words he believes were used at the meeting. They're still not defamatory. And the fact that he is acting to quell dissent, to quell disagreement, to punish people for exercising their First Amendment rights of freedom of speech is made evidently clear by the fact there's another email. This started with a complaint by one of the other parents who called Mr. Bilbrey, texted Mr. Bilbrey, and said he was going to make a complaint. That parent's name is Emerson. That email about Mr. Williams' on-field conduct and the fact that it was a potentially a poor example for children, was provided to Mr. Williams as an exhibit to Mr. Hall's motion to dismiss on August 30th. He doesn't file a motion to amend to seek to add Mr. Emerson as a party. He doesn't mention Mr. Emerson as a person he wants to depose. This is about him getting even with Mr. Hall and Mr. Bilbrey over what he sees as a slight. This is exactly the kind of lawsuit that the Texas Citizens Protection Act is intended to prevent, so that we don't have to spend people's times and lives dealing with a dispute like this. And I'll, unless you have any questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Beard to address the two issues that are peculiar to his client.
Okay, thanks, Nathan.
Thank you.
Do you go by Alex or Alexander, or what do you go by?
Alex.
Alex, okay.
May it please the court. I represent the other appellant in this case, Chuck Hall. Chuck Hall is the president of the Trophy Club Roanoke Baseball Association. He is a volunteer president. He gives of his time selflessly so that kids can be exposed to the game of baseball and experience it. But he also does it because he realizes that through organized sports, these kids can learn these important life lessons, some of which Mr. Bilbrey's counsel mentioned. Things like good sportsmanship and self-discipline. And they learn these lessons not simply through instruction, but by example. And that, of course, brings into play the on-field conduct of the adults, including the coaches. Now, Mr. Hall, as president, and he is required to wear a lot of hats. He's required to take care of tournament and game logistics, but one of the more unpleasant aspects of his job is he has to deal with complaints. Complaints about players, about coaches, and even about parents. And what the evidence in this case shows is that's all he did. There was an incident. It was brought to his attention the next morning. Before the actual formal complaint was ever made, he picked up the phone and called Mr. Williams and got his side of the story. He then obtained an account of the incident from the head coach, Tim Bilbrey, and then the very next day he responded to Mr. Williams' attorney. By that time he had already retained an attorney. And in his written response he said, "You know, I've investigated this, I've talked to Mr. Williams, I've obtained his feedback. Based on that feedback, there's no further action that's going to be taken. Mr. Williams is free to apply to be a coach next year, and I consider the matter closed." Well, that wasn't enough for Mr. Williams. He felt compelled to file a lawsuit. Now, I think that Mr. Bilbrey's counsel has done a good job of talking about the scope of the anti-SLAPP statute, and that's really the issue. It is whether this court is going to apply that statute so as to protect the rights of concerned parents and other individuals who witness on-field behavior that they deem to be inappropriate or potentially harmful to kids. That's what the case is about. And there were only two claims asserted against Mr. Hall. And before I go to those in the 2 minutes I have left, I would like to suggest to the court, I think it'd be very helpful to the court in analyzing these issues, especially the scope of the anti-SLAPP statute, to take a look at the Hesimovich case. That's the California Court of Appeals case that we cited in our brief. And we only included about a paragraph discussion of the case, but I went back and looked at it, and the facts are very similar and analogous to our case. You got a volunteer coach. You got very similar claims. You got defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. But what's really, I think, going to be helpful to the court is the court's discussion of the scope of the statute and what it applies to. Now, Now, turning to the two claims against Mr. Hall, one was conspiracy to defame, and the other was aiding and abetting. And I think it's important with respect to the conspiracy claim to point out that Mr. Hall never made any defamatory statements, nor does Mr. Williams even allege that he ever did. Okay? He wasn't even present at that meeting that took place among the parents. And you can see that from page 20 of the record, because Mr. Williams' attorney writes to Mr. Hall and says, why weren't you at the meeting? So he wasn't even at this meeting where supposedly some derogatory statements were made. But beyond that, if you look at the record, what you see is there is no evidence of the elements to support a conspiracy to defame claim. There's no evidence of an object to be accomplished. There's no evidence of a meeting of the minds on an object to be accomplished. And there's no evidence of an unlawful act. With respect to the aiding and abetting cause of action, well, there is no such animal under Texas law. The closest Texas law recognizes to any such cause of action is the concert of action, but even then, courts don't recognize it. It's an open question, but there's no evidence. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Thanks, Alex. Scott?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. The threshold issue this court has is whether the Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation Act, that's now a couple years old, is applicable in this case. If the court determines that the Anti-SLAPP Act is not applicable, then there's no further going. The other issues do not matter. The trial court denied the motions to dismiss. This court determines, again, the Anti-SLAPP Act is not applicable, then it can affirm right there. The one of the primary statements about the anti-SLAPP statement is in 27.02, which in part says the purpose of the act is to encourage and safeguard the constitutional rights of persons to petition, speak freely, associate freely, and otherwise participate in government. Most of the cases, as the court is well aware, in the two or three years the act has been around, have been media cases, whether it's TV, newspaper. There are several Better Business Bureau cases where comments are being made that all involve public concerns that affect all sorts of people, but also involve public communication in the way that the alleged defamatory statement is being communicated.
Mr. Hayes.
Yes.
We're supposed to read the legislature's words and try to get the plain meaning. And you just alluded to Section 27.002, which is the purpose clause.
Yes.
And please help me with your interpretation of the plain meaning of the first sentence when it talks about the rights of persons to petition, comma, speak freely, common, comma, associate freely, and otherwise participate in government. Now, those early statements of the words used to petition, comma, speak freely, comma, associate freely, are not really talking about a governmental function, are they?
I think not specifically a governmental function, but as the Wisenhort Court has recently looked at.
And I read their opinion, and it's very interesting, but I'm just talking about the plain language and the words that are used there. Do you interpret those words to be modified in a way that is that we're talking about speaking freely about governmental matters?
No, certainly, Your Honor. It is. I do not read that as the act is limited to statements made about participation in government. I do not read that.
Thank you.
Wisenhort Court didn't read that. I think that's the argument more is the intent through this language is it's that type of speech that is being aimed, and that goes directly to the public communication nature of the speech.
Which takes you back to the issue of what does ACT mean whenever they use the words public concern, which they specifically define in the definitions section in a very broad way.
That is in 27.017, the matter of public concern, which does have some rather broad descriptions of it. Number one, I would argue that the statements that we're here for today, with Mr. Bilbrey calling Mr. Williams an abuser, is not an issue of public concern. The statement, again, going back to my comments about the public communication nature, that was a private communication that was made by him. That wasn't put out on the internet. That wasn't put out in the paper. That was, again, the rest of our evidence is there was nothing that occurred to substantiate anything involving Mr. Williams' conduct. But again, we believe even the comments were not something that would be a public concern. But as important, we believe under the Act that there must be a public communication of that. And again, the Texarkana court goes to some length, and I think significantly also includes some statements by the sponsor of the bill, which at this point I think there's still an interpretation of the language and what it means, and legislative intent is certainly part of that. And throughout, which I have on page 17 of the brief, is almost all the language in that sponsorship talks about the public nature of the communication. It talks about the internet age. It basically is allowing everybody to go out, throw out their opinions, and that's not what this particular case is about. This is about a conversation, a defamatory conversation by Mr. Bilbrey to Mr. Hall. That's what we have here. To expand the scope and application of the Anti-SLAPP Act to a private communication of this nature, I would contend, is well beyond the intent in the language. And frankly, there's not any other cases out there that have, with facts like this, that have gone with a private communication and expanded this. Essentially, you could say every defamation lawsuit then, one way or the other, fits in, and it applies to every defamatory statement or every defamatory lawsuit. I don't think that's the intent. I don't believe that's the language of it. So again, our threshold issue, and again, the trial court denied the motions to dismiss of the appellants, and that was one of the issues that was raised, and we believe it's, again, not applicable, wasn't designed for something like this in any way, in any manner, to go through this type of procedure. In any event, believe the court should affirm on that basis. As we get secondarily, if the court does find it is applicable, then at that point the burden is on Mr. Williams to present through the evidence and pleadings the clear and specific evidence of a prima facie case for each of the elements of the claims. And as this court has discussed in the Lipsky case, that a standard of a minimum quantum of evidence necessary to support a rational inference that the party met the burden. And again, the evidence presented was that Mr. Bilbrey has called Mr. Williams an abuser. That is a defamatory statement. Mr. Williams, the evidence also shows, based upon that statement, suffered damages, saw a doctor. It was a statement that greatly bothered him in the community throughout. Again, that evidence is presented. We presented the evidence of a defamatory statement. Moving on to the conspiracy in aiding and abetting claims, and we have lengthy evidence as to, again, what happened here, that the evidence appears to show that there was clearly an effort to disparage Mr. Williams and get him removed from his position and also affect his son. As the evidence would show, and Mr. Williams gets the first phone call and is told that he's been called an abuser, and that's a harsh and extreme statement. That's what Mr. Hall told Mr. Williams at that time. And it said, I've talked to the umpires. And as the evidence showed, that was not accurate. He had not talked to the umpires. He tells Mr. Williams he'll get back to Mr. Williams with a meeting as to what's going to occur next. He doesn't do that. They then hold a meeting, and Mr. Williams' son, they don't follow the rules, is not put on the top team, and continuing actions have occurred. But again, the conspiracy was to disparage Mr. Williams, damage his reputation, get him out of the league. The evidence that we have set forth shows those particular points. Met our burden there. And finally, we had filed, the timing of this was that September 3rd is when their motion is received, and additional evidence comes in from the appellant September the 6th. September the 10th is the hearing. We filed a motion for continuance for additional discovery that might be necessary. The court, while denying that, then denies the motions to dismiss, so the issue of the discovery or continuance obviously was moot at that particular point in time. But if, in fact, the court is to take the position that the evidence, get to the second point, that the evidence is insufficient, then at that point it should be remanded for Mr. Williams to take additional discovery. Again, we believe we have the proper amount of discovery, but there was, again, no discovery conducted, and what you hear over here as well, they haven't shown this and that. So, but again, this was a private communication that under the Anti-SLAPP Act, it is not covered. The act would cover, again, all defamatory statements, I believe, if a private communication, which we have here, is considered to be under the act. So at that point, the court affirms. If it finds the anti-SLAPP is applicable, then we've set out evidence on all of our claims. And for that reason, it should be affirmed.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, Nathan.
Working backwards, since it's the most recent issue discussed, the discovery. The statute in 27006B provides that on a showing of good cause, the court may allow specified and limited discovery relevant to the motion. The reason for that's understandable. If you don't have that limitation, the very purpose of the act would disappear, because you could take the abuse of an intrusive discovery, the act's intended to spare people. So we have to look at what discovery did they ask for, and do they have good cause for it? Well, their motion for continuance specifies that they want to take the depositions of Joey Reagan, Becky McLean, Brandon Hennig, and Tim Bilbrey, short depositions, to determine the truth of the disputed conduct at the baseball game. What happened on the field, not what happened at the meeting Mr. Williams didn't get to attend, not what are the reasons behind the All-Star team's assignments and creations. He wants to focus on, did I yell at the umpire inappropriately or not? That's the fact issue. he wants discovery on. That was actually the only fact issue that he brought some evidence on to the court at trial. He had affidavits from other parents who were at that game saying he didn't yell at the umpire. So that was a contested fact issue. What he didn't have was any of the other clear evidence that he needed, that the statements were defamatory, that they might be defamation per se, since all he pled was slander per se, not libel under the statute. So there is no good cause for additional discovery. If the statute applies to serve the purpose of the statute, he's had his shot. In this case, should be the motions to dismiss should be granted. Now, unusually, this would not result in a pure render. It would result in an instruction to the trial court to then conduct the mandatory hearing on reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. But that's the result this court should reach, is the dismissals should have been granted. Stepping back from that and looking at the use of the term abuser, look at the two emails. Look at the email from Mr. Bilbrey that is in the appendix at tab 13. Look at the email that was sent by the parent, which is on page 42, I believe, of the clerk's record. It was an attachment to Mr. Hall's motion. Neither of them used the word abuser. They say he yelled at an adolescent in public. They say he was disrespectful to an adolescent umpire in public. They say he set a poor example in public of how to behave with sportsmanship in class. They don't call him an abuser. That word has to come from the meetings. And at that point, we're not talking about private communications. We're talking about what Mr. Williams believes was said about him at a small public meeting of the concerned public. And Wisenhunt, in footnote 5, makes it very clear that this statute doesn't just apply to comments made to the public at large through media. It applies in situations where the concerned public is relatively small. For governmental petitions, it could be the public that's the population of Leukenbach, Texas. That's not a lot of people, but that is the concerned public. It could be the public of the Ridgely North Homeowners Association or of this Little League Association. It does not have to be in newspapers. It does not have to be on the World Wide Web. If we're talking about meetings, meetings occur in small churches. They occur in condo associations. They occur in tenant associations for apartments. And all of those meetings are the kinds of meetings where slap lawsuits have over the years occurred. A homeowners association meeting on Chesapeake drilling. Somebody might say something that triggers a slap suit. Not a whole lot of people at that homeowners association, and it's not in the media that that statement was made, but they would have every right to be protected under this statute, and so do our clients, Mr. Hall and Mr. Bilbrey. Unless you have any questions, I'll
have a question. How do you address opposing counsel's argument that if the SLAPP Act applies in this situation, then it would apply to all defamation cases?
There are two distinctions there, both of which are actually addressed in the Wisenhunt opinion. The first is that it does still have to be a matter of public concern. Not all defamation is a matter of public concern. For example, one classic form of defamation per se would be to accuse an individual of not being able to pay their debts, to be a wastrel or spendthrift. And that's personal if you say that to a different person to prevent them from doing business, as opposed to, say, standing up at a church meeting and saying in front of 30 or 40 people, Brother Shatman shouldn't be the church treasurer, he's a spendthrift. That's a public statement on public concern. So each case, there probably really can't be a bright line rule. You have to look at what was said to whom, when, where, and how.
Questions?
Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, we appreciate your argument, appreciate you coming here today. Your case is submitted, and that is the end of our 1:30 docket, so you're free to go about your business, or you can hang around until we start the 3 o'clock docket and listen to that case.